presented by Nature Forward and themed Reclamation and Resilience, with both online and in-person participation for connection, knowledge, inspiration, and more. Details about Taking Nature Black Conference at natureforward.org/takingnatureblack. All one word, Taking Nature Black. That's Taking Nature Black, Reclamation and Resilience, March 5th through the 8th. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
I'm Muiza Muntali, host of African Now, and you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
Watch and comment for Tuesday, January 28th. I'm Dave Ravens, and I'm hearing an echo, but what the hey? Believe it or not, after the deluge that was transpired in the first week in the White House, there are certain issues that haven't made headlines, and one of them is the death penalty, which marches on despite Biden's 37 commutations of federal death row inmates. And what are the ongoing important variables in the death penalty sphere, including wrongful convictions, race, poverty, deterrence, public opinion, execution trends on both the federal and state levels, and the possibility of eradicating the death penalty altogether, and what's likely under Trump, who in his first term as president was the country's most prolific execution president in more than a century. Joining us is Avi Maher, executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center. Welcome, and welcome to callers. We really want to hear from you, 202-588-0893. Welcome, Ms. Maher.
Hi, David. It's great to be with you.
It's great to be with you. And, you know, what sort of caught my eye and a lot of eyes, I'm sure, was the execution of Marcellus Williams in September of last year. If you could talk about the case, because I think it is an example of a lot of the problems that we all are seeing with the death penalty policy.
Right. Well, Mr. Williams' case caught the attention of many people in the country outside of the state of Missouri, where he was sentenced to death. He had an incredibly credible case of innocence, a great deal of evidence that suggested he had been wrongfully convicted and sentenced to death. That evidence convinced the sitting prosecutor in Missouri to support his bid for a new trial. Ultimately, the attorney general in the state of Missouri intervened in a negotiated plea agreement and sought his execution, which eventually happened over the objection of more than a million people who signed an online clemency petition urging that he not be executed. Mr. Williams had a very powerful case of innocence, and I'm afraid his case illustrates the narrowing opportunities there are for people who are wrongfully convicted to secure relief from the courts.
I mean, if you could give some idea of what the evidence was supporting his plea not to be executed. I mean, it's really, rather outrageous, given that what the prosecutor in the case was saying, you know, this needs to be at the least revisited, and the victim's family was acting that he, in fact, be spared.
Well, that's right. And unfortunately, there was also contamination of the evidence by the prosecuting attorneys that interfered with his ability to argue that there was no DNA evidence that connected him to the crime. I mean, as I said, Mr. Williams' case was really profoundly troubling, but it is only one of many cases we are seeing across the country. Wrongfully convicted people who are having great difficulty accessing the courts, first of all, to even present their evidence of innocence, and then convincing the courts to give them a fair opportunity in court.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it was very, very troubling. It's what spurred, an opponent of the death penalty for a long time, but it was just particularly troubling, including the idea of the fact that the victim's family was asking that he be spared.
Well, that's right. And, you know, the Death Penalty Information Center, we are an organization that presents facts and information about the death penalty. We are not an advocacy organization, but you don't have to feel a particular way about the death penalty. In other words, you don't have to be an opponent of the death penalty in order to feel troubled by this case. No one, even supporters of the death penalty, want to see innocent people executed. So this is really a case that crossed all boundaries in terms of political affiliation or positions on the death penalty, religious, moral, or otherwise. It was a very, very upsetting case, and I think many people were stunned when he was nonetheless executed by the state of Missouri, despite all of this evidence that suggested he had been wrongfully convicted.
Yeah. I'm just being told by our dear engineer that we can't take callers, which is unfortunate. I'm sure people want to chime in. I'm sorry about that, folks that are in listener land, but such is the situation here at WPFW. Sorry about that. Why don't we take this particular horrific case to talk about innocence in a broader scale of what, since 1973, at least 200 individuals that have been sentenced to death have been exonerated. If you could talk about that.
Sure. Yeah, that's exactly right. 200 people who were convicted and sentenced to death, and some of them who came within hours of nearly being executed, have been exonerated. Interestingly, 65% of those exonerees are people of color. More than 50% are Black. Florida has the most exonerations with 30, 22 in Illinois, 18 in Texas. And collectively, these 200 people spent 2,621 years in prison for crimes they did not commit. The causes of wrongful conviction are many, unfortunately. So it's a difficult problem to solve, but we can start with the fact that official misconduct by state actors is a leading cause of wrongful conviction. About 142 of these 200 cases involved official misconduct. 131 involved perjury or false accusations. And about 61 of these cases involved false or misleading forensic evidence. So these are just some of the reasons that people are wrongfully convicted. I mean, fundamentally, we have to remember we are humans. This is a system of fallible human beings who make mistakes. That's one reason why many people say we should not be using the death penalty, because it's it's going to be a foregone conclusion that, that human beings in the system will make mistakes.
Yeah, I mean, it's rather extraordinary. That alone, it would seem to be, would be a reason to execute the, no pun intended or pun intended, the death penalty policy, and yet it seems to linger on and on. If you could talk about the Supreme Court's decision to put at least on hold the death penalty and then decide to reenact it.
Well, you're asking, I think, about the Supreme Court's decision in 1972. That was a case that was presented to the Supreme Court at a particular time in history. For one thing, the death penalty was used at an all-time low. Executions and new death sentences were very, very low at that time. But the death penalty itself was very different across the state. There were no way to really guide the discretion of jurors. People were convicted of different offenses and could receive death sentences for dramatically different crimes, including crimes that did not result in the death of a victim. So what was presented to the Supreme Court was the question of whether the death penalty was so arbitrary, that is, so inconsistently used, that it was unconstitutional. And the Supreme Court said yes. They also identified some serious concerns about racism and poverty and the vulnerability of the people who were selected for death at that time in history. So they said that the death penalty was unconstitutional as applied. It halted all executions across the country, and it resulted in a commutation of all of the people that were currently on death rows at that time to life without the possibility of parole. A few years later, the states had redrafted their state statutes and asked the court to permit them to resume sentencing people to death and executing them. And the Supreme Court looked at new statutes and approved of a particular set of procedures that they said would adequately address the problems they had identified in their earlier case, a case called Furman versus Georgia. This case in 1976, called Gregg versus Georgia, was a case that from Georgia that had new procedures and protections that were to address these serious concerns. For example, there was a bifurcated proceeding that was implemented that created a separate sentencing hearing for prisoners. There was an automatic appeal to the state Supreme Court to review the proportionality of the sentence. And the Supreme Court was also careful to say that not all murders will result in the death penalty. In fact, they said it should not. It should only be reserved for the very worst of the worst offenders, people that the jury found to be especially death worthy. So all of these processes were put in place to, again, address the concerns that were identified by the court just a few years earlier. And the question today is whether those changes have resulted significantly in addressing those concerns. I think many people would conclude they have not, that there is still a very arbitrary use of the death penalty, that it still has profound racial implications for people of color in the way that they are charged and sentenced, that innocent people are still being sentenced to death. So for many people, I think they've concluded those changes did not result in the changes they should have made.
I should say, I'm speaking with Robin Maher, Executive Director of the Death Penalty Information Center. It's such a troubling issue. Let's talk about the factor of race specifically. But your the information I understand is that if the victim is white, the defendant is more likely to get the death penalty than if the victim is black. If you could talk about that.
Sure. You know, the racial issues we see in the death penalty are really twofold. We see a profound racial effect based on the race of the defendant, but we see an even more profound effect based on the race of the victim. More than 75% of the prisoners who have been executed in the modern death penalty era, and that it goes all the years since the last decision I described, were convicted of killing a white person, despite the fact that African Americans, Black people, are more than half of homicide victims.
I mean, that's extremely troubling. So you're saying that more than half of the people that are executed are African American, the percentage of victims are disproportionately white.
What I'm saying is that more than 75% of the prisoners who've been executed were convicted of killing a white person, even though the statistics show that 50% of homicide victims are Black people. So clearly we're right. seeing a preference for executing people who have killed white people. That, of course, is something very troubling and uncomfortable about the way that we are valuing white life versus the lives of people of color.
I mean, it's extremely troubling. And yet the Supreme Court, and this is a Supreme Court that was far more progressive than the current court, in its infinite wisdom, decided that the death penalty was acceptable.
Yes, I'm sorry, David. I missed your last question.
Yeah, I'm just saying that the current Supreme Court is far, far more conservative than the court in the 70s that decided that the death penalty was acceptable.
Well, I think the current court may have a different philosophy than the court in 1972 or 1976. There's a difference in philosophy about whether this is the role of the Supreme Court to interfere with state death penalty cases. I think this Supreme Court, the majority of the members on this current court, believe that it is not their role, and they are content to leave it to the discretion of the states to decide whether they will use the death penalty and how.
Yeah, I mean, we need to understand that what the vast majority of executions are not federal defendants, they are state defendants.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, that's an important distinction that is very important in understanding and analyzing the death penalty issue. Any other thoughts about how race plays a part in the death penalty issue?
Well, there are actually many ways that race plays a role in who is selected for the death penalty. One of the biggest reasons is the jury that's chosen. We know that juries are chosen for death penalty cases through a particular process that is called jury death qualification in capital cases, which means that anyone who is seated on a jury has to agree that a death sentence is the appropriate, could be an appropriate sentence for that defendant, which means that someone like you, David, for example, who says he opposes the death penalty could never be on a capital jury. But what we also know is that some prosecutors may deliberately exclude people of color from juries because they believe that people of color may be more likely to vote against the death penalty. So over many, many years, first by operation of law and then really through practices, people of color have historically been excluded from juries. And that is not only to the detriment of defendants who are facing a life and death trial, but it's also to the detriment of those jurors who are denied their opportunity to participate in a jury. That is their right as well. So over the years, the law has tried and largely failed to stop this practice. And we still see that many cases, even from current day, involve prosecutors who are illegally excluding people of color from those juries.
It's really a daunting problem. So I personally, I imagine you personally, are opposed to the death penalty, and you and I could not serve on a jury. It's really a troubling consideration. What's your idea, your recommendation? I know you say you're not an advocacy organization. I understand that, but what are advocates, opponents of the death penalty saying about what one can do to change the situation for who is considered acceptable for a jury?
Well, I think the best thing to do is to vote for prosecutors who are thinking about the death penalty in a responsible way. These are largely the decisions of prosecutors. Defenders, of course, are going to be more likely to include a greater diversity of people on a capital jury, because we've seen from the data that the more diverse the jury, the longer people will deliberate, the more robust the conversations during deliberations, the more carefully evidence will be evaluated. When juries are just made up of all white people or even all white men, as they were historically often characterized, then we know that the conversations are very different in the jury room. So electing prosecutors who care about these issues and are aware of the problems that we've had historically excluding people of color from juries, I think, is probably the best thing that we can do as voters.
Right, but it isn't even just a question of race. If I'm a white person and I'm opposed to the death penalty, I'm unlikely to be able to serve on a jury.
Well, the law currently is that if you are irrevocably opposed to ever sentencing someone to death, that means that you can be lawfully excluded from the jury. I mean, the same is also true of someone who says, I will always sentence someone to death if they are convicted of a terrible crime. So on either end of the spectrum, the law permits those folks to be excluded from a capital jury. But I think we see the largest number of people excluded from the end where they have concerns or serious difficulties with sentencing someone to death. And now people who say they are concerned about the issue, but could possibly sentence someone to death if that were appropriate, given all of the evidence, that is someone who would be permitted to serve on the jury under the current law.
Yeah. Any thoughts about how all of this unfolds in a allegedly Christian nation that I believe by its tenets would be antithetical to the death penalty? Maybe that's something that gets into advocacy that you don't want to touch on, but it just personally to me seems outrageous that an allegedly Christian nation would be supportive of such a policy.
Well, it's true that there are many faith leaders and positions that religious organizations and faiths have taken that are supportive of abolition. We've seen some tremendous support, for example, from Catholic organizations. Pope Francis tweeted and personally messaged President Biden and was very supportive of the commutations of the 37 men on the federal death row that President Biden ultimately resentenced to death, to life, excuse me. So the Catholic organizations, the bishops' organizations, Catholic Mobilizing Organization has been doing some tremendous work. So we've seen a lot of really thoughtful work done by evangelicals and other religious organizations that have been tremendously helpful, not only in individual cases, but in support of other advocates' efforts to restrict the use of the death penalty in their jurisdictions or abolish it altogether.
Yeah. Let's touch on how poverty plays into this whole policy, this whole dynamic of the death penalty. It's obviously an advantage of your O.J. Simpson with the best attorneys money can buy versus, Joe Sixpack or however you want to describe the average American dealing with a capital case.
Well, that's right. I mean, we've always known that poor people, and that's not true just in the United States, but around the world, people without resources, without constituents, without advocates are targeted, selected for the death penalty much more frequently than people who have a community that they can rely upon to intercede on their behalf. And of course, resources, financial resources are incredibly important in the United States because finding a good lawyer, securing a lawyer who has the skills and the experience and the resources to do the kind of job that you need done at trial and in post-conviction is really what makes the difference between life and death. Here in the United States, we have some incredibly hardworking public defenders who are working very, very hard on behalf of their clients in many of the states that use the death penalty. But of course, often they are not resourced adequately. And so they are trying to do the best they can with limited resources and are very often outspent by the prosecutor's office. And the reason that's so important is because we have an adversary system of justice. And that means that we need both sides to be equally trained and resourced and skilled in order for the truth, the best outcome to result from that conflict in the courts. And when one side has all of the resources, it does not result in a just outcome. It results in injustice. So resources mean everything here in the United States. In state post-conviction, there is no federal constitutional right to a lawyer, which means that many people in state who have been convicted of state death penalty offenses are really scrambling to try to find a good lawyer who can raise all of the issues they need to be raised on appeal. That's their best avenue to correcting the mistakes that might have occurred at trial. And without a good lawyer in the post-conviction process, again, the answer is that we will not have a just result. We will have only an unjust result. And what's worse is that the evidentiary record that's created in that state process is the one that the federal courts must use. So it really, really hampers their ability both in state court and in federal court. Those are the appeals that are available to most death sentence prisoners. Again, lawyers who are trained and experienced and adequately resourced are the key being able to prevail and to get a fair result in the courts. Otherwise, we have situations like Mr. Williams and so many others who don't have good lawyers until the very last moment and then are trying to get back into court. By operation of law, they are usually prevented from doing so. And that creates just a terrible situation where someone with very viable legal claims and evidence is simply unable to present them in court. So right, you're right. Resources, your status as someone with means and access to a community that can support you has everything to do with whether you are going to be able to get a fair and just result at trial or on appeal.
So in this country, you have a right to an attorney at the trial level. You get a public defender at the trial level, but you're, if I'm understanding correctly, you have no right to an attorney on the appeal process?
So at trial, you have a constitutional, a federal constitutional right under the Sixth Amendment to a lawyer. That means a lawyer will be appointed for you if you cannot afford to hire your own lawyer. And the majority of the people who are facing a possible death sentence need the assistance of a public defender. That public defender is someone who is funded and trained usually by the county or the state. And so the resources there may be very different from those that are received by, for example, the district attorney's office, the prosecutors. After the trial, you will receive a lawyer for the direct appeal, which is the first appeal that happens that only takes into account what happened at trial. But for the state post-conviction process, there is no federal constitutional right to a lawyer. And so in places like Alabama, for example, prisoners there need to rely on volunteers who come into the state to represent them or other organizations that can provide them with a lawyer. The state of Alabama refuses to provide them with a lawyer for that state appeal. And so the answer to your question is it really depends on the state where you live and what the state has decided it will do by way of providing legal representation. I mean, that's true generally of many things in the death penalty. It's very difficult to talk about the death penalty in a single voice because we have 50 sovereign governments here in the United States. They all get to make their own decisions about whether they will use the death penalty and how they will use the death penalty. They have their own set of laws and procedures. They have their own constitutions. So the death penalty is very different from place to place. In Alabama, it is very different from how it is used in California. Both of those states have the death penalty, but there are dramatic differences between those two jurisdictions. So it really very much depends on where you live and who you elect locally.
Wow. So what happened in the case of Marcellus Williams in Missouri? He was executed in September. How would you evaluate the kind of representation that he got in his appeals process?
Well, Mr. Williams got terrific lawyers at the very end, and I don't know all of the lawyers who were involved every step of the way, but I do know that the Innocence Project stepped in quite early in his case. There were some local attorneys in Missouri that were fighting an absolutely heroic battle for him. You know, it often comes to the fact that very late in the process, good lawyers get involved. And again, by operation of law, it's very difficult to undo the mistakes that were made early on. In Mr. Williams' case, at trial, the prosecution's case against him was based entirely on the unreliable testimony of two witnesses who were incentivized for their testimony. And those, you know, that should have been a red flag right there, because we know, as I said earlier, that very often witnesses are mistaken, and particularly when they are incentivized, i.e. they were given some reward for their testimony, then that witness is highly suspect. That testimony is highly suspect. So there was a crime scene for Mr. Williams that had lots of forensic evidence available, but there was no direct link to Mr. Williams. That's another big red flag. I mean, why not? And, you know, there was lots. Mr. Williams, by the way, was someone who proclaimed his innocence right from the very beginning. He maintained his innocence throughout. And there was evidence of racial bias, of course, in this case as well. So, I mean, there are lots of things here, very common things that we see in other cases, other wrongful conviction cases. I will say that there was an absolutely tremendous effort made on his behalf by the lawyers who joined with so many other concerned citizens in Missouri and really around the country who were very offended by what they saw and very upset about the fact that he was scheduled for an execution despite this this body of evidence that suggested he was innocent.
I mean, it was just so troubling. I mean, he had, I think we can say, an exemplary record in prison. He was a spiritual counselor to other prisoners. I don't know all the details. I'm sure you do. I mean, it's extraordinarily troubling.
Well, it is. And again, I think probably the most troubling thing about this, aside from the tragedy that was, is the fact that his case is not an isolated incident. We've had so many other cases this year of people who are on death row who do not belong there. And, you know, I think it's a real moment for us to think hard about how we are using the death penalty when we are seeing this many people with very troubling incidents of wrongful conviction, and yet they are unable to secure the kind of relief they need in court. Now, in Mr. Williams' case, I will say one of the most positive signs was that the sitting district attorney in that case, he was not the person who prosecuted Mr. Williams, but he was the prosecutor who took over after Mr. Williams was convicted. He supported Mr. Williams' request for a new trial. He also supported a plea agreement that would have moved him off of death row. And it's very encouraging to see elected officials like that gentleman, like others. We saw this also in Texas. We saw state legislators in Texas supporting Robert Roberson, who is also a person who is very likely wrongfully convicted and on death row in Texas. Melissa Lucio, also on Texas's death row, who was wrongfully convicted. There's a case in Alabama where state officials have come out publicly in support of Toforis Johnson, who is also wrongfully convicted. We have many, many cases, and I think what's troubling for most people is to understand why there is a push for execution when there are so many questions. Why not just take the additional time that's necessary to resolve these questions satisfactorily and not rush to an execution?
Right. It seems, if I recall correctly, you know, politics played a role, and the Attorney General of Missouri in Mr. Williams' case had his finger to the wind and decided that the best way to go was to push forward with the execution.
Well, the reality is the death penalty has always been political. It has been political for as long as it has been used in human history. Politicians use it as a fairly simple answer to the very complex problem of what to do about violent crime. You know, violent crime is a problem that worries all of us. It's a very natural thing to be concerned about. No one ever wants to lose a loved one to violent crime, but using the death penalty has been proven not to be the answer that many politicians suggest it is. We've now seen that there's really no proof that it has any kind of deterrent effect. Many people have tried and failed to show that it does deter future crime. So politicians who've promised for many years that using the death penalty will keep us safer really don't have a good answer to that conundrum. It's an incredibly expensive policy. It costs millions and millions of dollars to secure death sentences and to proceed to execution. And ultimately, people in communities around the country are concluding that they have better things they would like to have their taxpayer dollars devoted to, other priorities that will bring them more meaningful answers than the death penalty does. We now see that support for the death penalty nationally is at a five-decade low. 53% nationally support use of the death penalty. But I continue to think that if you dig into those numbers a little bit, you'll find even stronger opposition. Many people are uncomfortable with the idea of executing people with severe mental illness or intellectual disability. And we know that among younger populations, people ages 18 to 43, a majority of those people oppose the death penalty. So things are changing. Younger generations, perhaps because they've seen the sorts of evidence like Mr. Williams and other cases, they are much more reluctant to use the death penalty. And we see this effect most profoundly in the number of new death sentences in the United States, even in states where the death penalty is still being used actively, and that's a minority of states. Juries are much more reluctant to return death sentences than they ever were. You know, just 20 years ago, death sentences were five times higher. New death sentences every year were five times higher than they were in 2024. And I think that's because, as I said, people have seen cases of innocence like Mr. Williams. They're troubled by the fact that he was executed despite those serious questions about his guilt. And they've also seen how expensive and ineffective the death penalty has been in their communities. So they're choosing other answers. They're choosing other sentences other than death.
Right. I mean, but it's discouraging, at least on its face, that we have just seen the end of the Biden administration, and Biden, despite his tough on crime history, was, I think we could say, maybe not overtly, an opponent of the death penalty, and now we have a president who is very much clearly a proponent of the death penalty.
Well, right. Mr. President Biden had a tremendous journey from a zealous supporter of the death penalty to someone who was publicly skeptical of its use and who declared that he would work to abolish the federal death penalty. He changed, as a lot of people have changed over the years, given all of the evidence that's been presented regarding its use. And he became very troubled, I think, by especially the racial disparities that were documented over and over again with respect to use of the federal death penalty. President Trump is someone very different. He has always been, I think, an enthusiastic supporter of the death penalty. We saw an unprecedented execution spree of 13 people when he was last in office, 13 people killed within a six-month time, people that were on the federal death row, including one woman, very profoundly ill woman, Lisa Montgomery. And he has telegraphed very, very clearly that he intends to use the death penalty when he is now back in office. So I think we need to be ready for some changes. Certainly, he's going to be a very different president than President Biden was in many respects.
Yeah. What do you think about speaking of former President Biden and his commutation of 37 of what, the 40 federal defendants on death row? What do you think about that commutation?
Well, I think that President Biden made a thoughtful decision that was a result of his reflection. It was a decision that was, I think, part of his conscience. He had been lobbied by many people that this was the right thing to do. And ultimately, it turned out that he was persuaded by the many arguments and the evidence that was presented to him that the federal death penalty had been used in a way that was arbitrary and unfair and racially biased. And he decided to do something about that on the way out of office, which was a very courageous thing for him to do. Certainly, he has been criticized by some, but largely he has been congratulated, I think, by most of the voices that I've seen, because they understand that there were some profound problems with the federal death penalty that he was seeking to address with these commutations.
Yeah, and we've touched on it. I want to go back at the end of our interview to what's likely to happen, but I want to go back to deterrence. We've touched on it, and I think you're saying that the death penalty, in fact, is not a deterrent to capital crimes.
Well, what I'm saying is that there have been many studies conducted that have tried to demonstrate a link, a deterrent effect between use of the death penalty and the deterrence of future crime. You know, the promise of the death penalty, use of the death penalty, was that people would be afraid to commit crimes because of the penalty that was threatened. So if they knew that the death penalty was available, they wouldn't commit violent crime. But the reality has shown that that's just not something that can be empirically proven. And we also know that many people who are committing violent crimes are doing so not because they're thinking through the consequences of what might happen, but they're doing it for other reasons. There are many vulnerable people who are struggling with mental illness, severe mental illness, or other brain impairments that affects their judgment and affects their behavior. And for those people, they're not really deterred by the possibility that they may face a possible punishment down the road. So again, this is studies have tried and failed repeatedly to demonstrate a deterrent effect. So I think what we're left with is really the notion that the death penalty is used as retribution. It is the strongest possible response to the most severe crimes. I think even most people who are supporting of the death penalty today would say that that is the justification. They really sort of let go of this idea that it could prove to be any kind of deterrent because it really just has not shown to be a deterrent of any kind.
Yeah. And what is the opinion, if you will, of human rights organizations, international or national human rights organizations regarding the death penalty? How does the United States stack up against the other believed Western democracies?
Well, the global community largely condemns use of the death penalty, with a majority of countries in the world supporting a moratorium as a first step toward abolition. The death penalty has been abolished in practice or in law in 144 countries. And just this last year, we saw abolition efforts growing with four other countries joining that group. Unfortunately, we also saw an increase in global executions increasing last year, and that's largely because of just a handful of countries. The United States is number five in known executions worldwide, behind Iran, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and North Korea. You didn't hear China in that list, and that's because China's number of executions each year is considered to be a state secret. They do not release those numbers publicly, but most human rights organizations will acknowledge that thousands of executions occur every year in China. So we are in
thousands,
a very unusual group of countries. We do not have much in common with Iran, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and North Korea, or even with China. But we are in this group of countries that still conducts executions. And so the answer is that we are in a dwindling group of countries. The march toward abolition worldwide is definitely continuing. And I think it will continue. Most international organizations support abolition and encourage abolition of the death penalty. So we are going to see ourselves in a smaller and smaller group of countries. None of our European allies, for example, continue to use the death penalty. The European Union has loudly condemned our use of the death penalty here in the United States. So it's a very uncomfortable situation, I think, for us, and it may have effects on future trade agreements and other international work that we intend to do in the international community.
That's hopeful note. Another hopeful note is what the governor of North Carolina did on his way out. I think a serious number of commutations, if I'm understanding correctly.
You are. This was, again, the result of a tremendous effort by local advocates in North Carolina. They were urging Governor Cooper to consider commuting the death sentences of many or all of the people on North Carolina's death row before he left office. And that was really because of some of the same issues they identified in North Carolina's death row that advocates identified in the federal death penalty, most particularly racial disparities. You know, for a time in North Carolina, prosecutors were unable as a matter of law to accept any plea bargains. And so they were forced seek the death penalty in many, many cases. And it resulted in the majority of the people on North Carolina's death row arriving there during this superheated, overzealous prosecutorial policy period of time. And so I think Governor Cooper was concerned about that. He was also concerned about the young age of many of the people that were on the North Carolina death row. And in deciding to commute the death sentences of 15 of them, he focused on a majority of the people of who received those commutations were people of color. And many of them were people who were convicted and sentenced to death row at a very young age. You know, we know, of course, much more today than we ever have known about how juvenile brains develop. We know that for young people, they are often acting impulsively. They don't appreciate the long-term consequences of their actions, and that's because their brains haven't fully developed. Now, scientists are telling us, really until sometime in the early 20s. So for people who are convicted or accused of crimes at a young age, we need to understand that they are often less culpable than other people are because their brains have not adequately developed. And I think Governor Cooper was persuaded by the science and by the arguments of many concerned people in North Carolina and even outside that state that this was an action that he needed to take to remedy some of the mistakes that had been made.
Yeah. And it isn't just former Governor Cooper. I learned from your wonderful website, which I can't recommend enough, just Google Death Penalty Information Center, that even offspring of two presidents or one president, Jeb Bush, is voicing concerns about the death penalty in the 2 minutes that we have left.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's something that we should really commend our elected officials for doing, which is being willing to grow and change, to learn from new information, from evidence, especially science, that gives us a new insight on our use of the death penalty and perhaps on decisions that we've made in the past. I have a lot of admiration for people who can continue to change and grow as President Biden has and many others who've now said, you know what, we don't need to use the death penalty. It's not the answer that I thought it was. And I think those are going to be attitudes and changes that we continue to see in our society.
So, in the minute that we have left here, you sound hopeful about the possibilities for change in this country in terms of eradicating the death penalty.
Well, again, we're not an organization that is seeking any particular result, but what I do think is that the more people understand about how the death penalty is used and some of the many problems that we've identified with its use, the more they will be reluctant to use it. There are other answers out there that do not involve seeking the execution of someone who's even those who've committed a terrible crime. Historically, we are very concerned about the ongoing racial bias that has been there since the beginnings of the use of the death penalty, and we really don't see an end to that. And so for that reason alone, we should be looking at other solutions. But again, please come visit our website. We are at deathpenaltyinfo.org, where you can find lots of information that will help you understand more about how the death penalty is being used in the United States and internationally today.
And I can't recommend enough checking out the Death Penalty Information Center website. It's really terrific. I learned a lot in preparing for this program and much appreciated. I've been speaking with the executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center, Robin Maurer. Thank you very much for joining us today and for all that you're doing.
Oh, it's a great pleasure, David. Thank you, and thank you to all your listeners.
I really appreciate it. Take care. Thanks to the amazing Mike Nasella for pulling us through this program. Have a great week. Stay safe. We'll see you next week.
host of Democracy Now!, asking you to support WPFW. We ask you, please, to go to the website and make a pledge, maybe $47 or $470 if you can, or $47 a month, to WPFW.org. Hey, if you want to get dinner and a show in New York, if you want to bring a guest with you, maybe your partner or daughter or son, a friend you want to meet up with in New York, watch the broadcast of Democracy Now! Live, 8 in the morning, sit on the set as we broadcast on over 1,000 stations, and then I get to personally host you for a meal, and we will toast WPFW, and it is an amazing time. We call it dinner and a show, you and your special guest. That's a $2,000 tax-deductible charitable contribution that goes directly to WPFW. Go online at WPFW.org. And by the way, you don't have to know when you can come to New York, where Democracy Now! Is based. Just make that call or go online at WPFW.org, make the pledge, and then we'll get in touch with you and work out the details. Maybe you're coming to New York soon or it won't be for a year. This doesn't expire because we don't want WPFW to expire. Again, go to WPFW.org. And thank you so much.
Do you have a car that you're not using anymore? Help your community radio station by donating your used vehicle to WPFW, where it will be sold at auction, and the proceeds will help keep your favorite jazz and justice station alive and running. The benefit? You get a tax write-off while supporting quality programming.
That's what I'm talking about.
For more information, just call 1-866-WPFW-CAR. That's 1-866-WPFW-CAR.
Hi, I'm Renee Bowser, a staunch trade unionist and host of a new WPFW program, Unionism Drives Community, airing Thursdays at 5 p.m. We will share the importance of knowing your rights in the workplace, the impact of unionism on working class advancement beyond the workplace, and how unionism can activate robust community among all of us. That's Unionism Drives Community, Thursdays at 5 p.m. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
This is Rev Yearwood. And I am so excited to announce our new climate show, Think 100% Climate Friday. This show will keep you up to date on everything climate justice related in a rapidly changing world. We will discuss breaking news and updates on environmental issues, the climate crisis, COVID-19, and politics. This show will make tangible how the climate crisis has already impacted our lives and what you can do about it. So tune in every Friday at 9 o'clock a.m. right here on WPFW 89.3, your jazz and justice station.
Climate Friday host Reverend Lennox Yearwood Jr. is but one of the black voices in climate and environmental justice that will be featured at this year's Taking Nature Black Conference, March 5th through the 8th. Presented by Nature Forward and themed Reclamation and Resilience, with both online and in-person participation for connection, knowledge, inspiration, and more. Details about Taking Nature Black Conference at natureforward.org/takingnatureblack, all one word, Taking Nature Black. That's Taking Nature Black, Reclamation and Resilience, March 5th through the 8th. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Greetings. WPFW is pleased to announce the relaunch of our major donor program, now known as the Jazz and Justice Circle. If you gave $1,000 last year or so far this year, you are automatically enrolled in this cherished group of listener members, and we thank you. Benefits of your membership are at WPFWFM.org under the Support Us tab at the top of the homepage is the Jazz and Justice Circle. Interested in joining this select group? Please consider a donation of